Coming up next from the Grassy Knoll, a terrifying look into the Orwellian world of brainwashing, disinformation, and ultimately, control over
you.
This is the beginning of the road to Orwell, Part 4. A couple of responses from listeners. First says, in answering your question whether 1984 was a warning or a prophecy, I refer to Why I Write, written by Orwell, published in 1946. And this is a quote. The Spanish War and other events in 1936-37 turned the scale, and thereafter I knew where I stood. Every line of serious work I have written since 1936 has been written directly or indirectly against totalitarianism and for democratic socialism, as I understand it. End of quote. In this essay, Orwell essentially says his purpose of writing is political. He defines political as, quote, the desire to push the world in a certain direction, to alter other people's idea of the kind of society they should strive after. End of quote. This does not sound like a man with a fatalistic worldview. That is true, but it almost sounds, honestly, like the mission of, say, Tavistock. And now, do we have a connection between the two, or don't we? That is Tavistock and Orwell. All right, moving on to the email. In Orwell's essay, The Lion and the Unicorn, Socialism and the English Genius, also published in 1946, reflect similar attitudes. In assessing Chamberlain's appeasement policy, Orwell states his belief that conditions occurred as the result of a series of blunders rather than deceptive, cold calculation. He states, quote, in spite of the campaigns of a few thousand left-wingers, it is fairly certain that the bulk of English people were behind Chamberlain's foreign policy. More, it is fairly certain that the same struggle was going on in Chamberlain's mind as in the mind of ordinary people. His opponents professed to see him in a dark... All right, that, oh, boy, I tell you. Where does that quote end? Okay. All right. There's no end of... Well, I tell you what. Yeah, let me continue. I'm a little confused here as to whether this is a whole quote and who he's... All right. He's talking about Chamberlain, so excuse me for that interruption. More, it is fairly certain that the same struggle was going on in Chamberlain's mind as in the mind of ordinary people. His opponents, Chamberlain's that is, profess to see him in a dark and wily schemer plotting to sell England to Hitler, but it is far likelier that he was merely a stupid man doing his best according to his very dim lights. It's difficult otherwise to explain the contradictions of his policy, his failure to grasp any of the courses of action open to him. Like the mass of people, he did not want to pay the price either of peace or war. End of quote. Sorry for muddying that up a bit. All right, that was the end of the quote. So here again, the future is changeable and open to many possibilities. Another strident theme in this essay is Orwell's hate of the moneyed class. He states, quote, for long past there had been in England an entirely functionless class. Living on money that was invested, they hardly knew where. The idle rich, the people whose photograph you can look at in the Tatler and the Bystander, always supposing that that you want to. The existence of these people was by any standard unjustifiable. They are simply parasites, less useful to society than his art to a dog. Okay, that's rough prose from him. Sorry about that, but that was the end of the quote. He believed the war would eliminate this class of people and a truly democratic socialist society would take its place. This would only be possible if England defeated Hitler, which would cause a rise in consciousness of the working people. All right, fast forward to the end of the war, with the same money class still in power and carving up the spoils of Europe with Stalin. This must have been deeply disappointing to Orwell. The evidence in these two essays lead me to believe Orwell was writing as a warning. However, I'm open to the possibility that Orwell had a change of heart toward the end of the war and immediately after it. Did he learn something that caused him to become more fatalistic and prophetic? I'm open to that. again, if Orwell wrote for the BBC and he knew he had to write in a certain manner, which was propaganda, Tavistock, as we know, is a think tank that created pop propaganda, especially to manipulate people to be accepting of a war. If this link is indeed true between Tavistock and Orwell, as some do write, you have to believe that sooner or later he knew the way things were going, that he didn't understand about Hitler and Stalin being part of the script. That's interesting. And if he didn't know it at the time, yeah, I'm assuming he did at the end, if he got jaded perhaps for the final time. But I'm not going to monopolize this with my thoughts. I just think that, and we'll go on to some others. Okay, let's just do that. All right, another email. I was listening to your second Road to Orwell program yesterday, and I do seem to recall hearing Alan Watt at some point, but maybe not in one of your interviews with him, saying that Orwell knew that both sides in World War II were being played. Reading The Lion and the Unicorn, there seems to be very little evidence of this at that point. Personally, I think Orwell wanted to join up because of what he describes as patriotism, but not in any particularly negative sense. In The Lion and the Unicorn, he describes the particular English/British form of patriotism, saying that, quote, in the working class, patriotism is profound, but is unconscious. The working man's heart does not leap when he sees a Union Jack, but the famous insularity and xenophobia of the English is stronger in the working class than in the bourgeoisie. The English working class are outstanding in their abhorrence of foreign habits. During the War of 1914-1918, the English working class were in contact with foreigners to an extent that is rarely possible. The sole result was that they brought back a hatred of all Europeans. And in parentheses, page 65 from the collected essays. Again, I know publisher two in that, but that's okay. And slightly earlier, quote, it is quite true that the so-called races of Britain feel themselves to be very different from one another. But somehow these differences fade away the moment that any two Britons are confronted by a European. Page 64 from Collected Essays. This also relates to what Robert Graves said about conscientious objectors during the 1914-18 war in his autobiography, Goodbye to All That, that they should be shot. It wasn't something he had against objecting, but the fact that they refused to contribute to the national effort during wartime. That isn't patriotism to a flag or something abstract, but to a people. It seems to me very different and something Orwell felt, too. In short, as Orwell describes it, and it certainly is true today as it was in the 1940s, that English patriotism isn't the kind of flag-waving jingoism that is often presented by the media, but something much more profound. And I see no reason why, when presented with either Germany or perhaps Russia invading Britain, parentheses, as he actually posits, in the parentheses, he shouldn't have felt the desire to do something about it in any practical way he could. After all, he already had combat experience in Spain, so knowing that the two sides were being played is either untrue or irrelevant. A third email. Just another brief thought on what Orwell said about the British ruling classes. He states that they retreated into a profound stupidity during the first part of the 20th century on all levels, refusing to believe that the world around them was changing and resulting in the debacle that was Britain in the 1930s, 40s, and World War II. How then do all clues and fingers point to London as the spider in the current web of the NWO, etc.? I'm sure there are reasons, but I'm just not connecting those dots. I'm going to continue with the email, but I had answered this, in fact. How does it get back to London? It gets back to the city of London, and what I believe is the Rothschild banking families and what they would call the labor Zionists, who have always wanted to, shall we say, capture the city of Jerusalem, as is the Vatican's desire as well, because obviously in the schema I'm coming from Christian scripture, it states that Satan desires Jerusalem to rule the world from, and I believe that these factions are doing his bidding. So that's how I think it gets back to the city of London, not London and Britishers, the city of London. Final paragraph from this third email. One thing about reading Orwell's essays, broadcasts, and letters is that you do get a very much clearer picture of the various forces, parties, groups, and players at work during that period. And a second thing might be that much of his writing contradicts what many commentators in the, quote, alternative media, unquote, today have said about him and what he was writing about. The best example I've seen in his article about, and this is the article's title, Wells, Hitler, and the World State, and how H.G. Wells, despite being prophetic in many things, was a man stuck deeply in the 19th century and was of, quote, a non-military nation and class, end of quote, and so incapable of seeing the dangers Hitler and Stalin presented. This essay in some ways debunks what Alan Watt had said about Wells and Huxley, funnily enough. Okay. There's a lot there, and you know, I don't think it's the time for me to comment to it. You're really not asking me to. I mean, it's really a jump ball for you folks out there to deal with. You know, again, nothing earth-shattering in the sense of it'll change the world perhaps hinges on this. But obviously, Orwell is a complex person, will remain enigmatic to this forever, very talented. And I would have to say this, it seems clear to me, and you folks can chime in on it too, and even with Gordon Comstock, with whom I've spoken about Orwell, you know, across some time. And that is, I do believe that there were stages in his life, and I think that they occurred with a certain manner of rapidity after Spain. And things might have become very clear during World War II and afterwards. And of course, just looking at what he wrote about in 1984, I mean, you know, it's happening, and I don't think it's a stretch of our imagination that we are, in a sense, you know, elasticizing what he wrote in 1984 and making an apply to what's happening today. I think it falls in a very congruous manner with what is going on. And one thing I did comment about in the preface, and I'll just state real quickly here, and that is there was a spate of anti-Muslim articles and whatever that came through last week. That's not a coincidence. And I see it as, quote, the Ministry of Truth over here elsewhere, sending this stuff through every so often. Because this does happen cyclically. You know, it's if it isn't the avian flu, it's something else. But all of a sudden, this stuff comes to me from everywhere. And that's not a coincidence. It's not the same stuff. So I think you have to consider that happening in light of what Orwell wrote about group hate. What's the difference? So, and anyway, we did a show quite some time ago where I took excerpts of 1984 in which Emmanuel Goldstein was included, and I just supplanted Osama bin Laden's name for Goldstein. And I mean, you know where I'm going with that. I mean, it was perfect. Getting back into the book Orwell, The Road to Airstrip 1 by Ian Slater, we'll start with the beginning of Chapter 10, the very outset of it. I just see 9, 10, and 11 being just loaded with the stuff that applies to us today and probably gives a pretty keen insight into Orwell, though that may always stay problematic. And by the way, if you hear any thunder in the background, this is being recorded this Saturday, since you're listening to it on the 4th. This is the 2nd. And we just got a tropical storm come through, and it was beautiful. I felt like a little kid when the blizzard came. We needed it badly. We're in a band right now that's kind of clear. But thank goodness, because this place was just like I said, walking on shredded newspaper. All right, here we go. Chapter 10. For Orwell, the most pressing danger of the tendency toward greater centralization of government, exemplified in the party's control of the language, was that the, quote, autonomous individual, end of quote, was threatened with extinction. The threat was particularly ominous for writers, who helped to preserve the tradition of debate, and dictatorships aside, the most invidious aspect of this danger was, as Blair had discovered in The Rich's Exploitation of the Poor, that it was often unintentional. Orwell saw that the constant change, constant and increasing assault against a writer's integrity, while it is a result of monopoly control over the media, is caused more by the general drift of society rather than by active persecution. Still, the result of monopoly, particularly in wartime, when propagandists were in demand, was that the writer found it necessary at least to earn part of his living by hack work. This meant joining institutions like the Ministry of Information and the BBC that, while helping the writer to subsist, often dictated a writer's opinions, turning him or her into a kind of petty bureaucrat espousing only official policy. In such cases, notes Orwell, the writer is called a reporter, but is treated as a megaphone. Woo! It is a short step from that position to one that would characterize a totalitarian state like Oceania, Where? Because four ministries comprise the entire governmental apparatus. People like Syme, Winston Smith, and Ampleforth, who have any literary skill or presentations at all, find themselves employed by the Ministry of Truth. In performing his job, Winston, completely untroubled by his deliberate falsification of history and current events, is as determined as any of his co-workers to excel in the art of deception, making it impossible, for example, for any human being to prove by documentary evidence that war with Eurasia had ever happened. Once again, Orwell draws heavily on his own experience in portraying a fictional character. It is in his wartime diary, not Winston Smith's, that we read. And here's the quote. I have now been in the BBC, in brackets, where the name Stalin was completely sacrosanct, end of brackets, about 6 months. Its atmosphere is something halfway between a girl's school and a lunatic asylum. Nevertheless, one rapidly becomes propaganda-minded and develops a cunning one did not previously have. Ergo, I am regularly alleging in all my newsletters, in brackets, broadcast to India, end of brackets, that the Japanese are plotting to attack Russia. I don't believe this to be so, but the calculation is, in a colon, if the Japanese do attack, we can say, I told you so. If the Russians attack first, we can, having built up the picture of a Japanese plot beforehand, pretend that it was the Japanese who started it. If no war breaks out after all, we can claim that it is because the Japanese are too frightened of Russia. I'm just taking a look here to see if there's any footnotes worth telling you guys about. No. Okay, that's that. All right, now to the narrative. While this is an honest moment for Orwell, it is hardly a proud one. It does show, however, that well before he wrote Animal Form in 1984, he had experienced not only the temptation of, but the surrender to, what he later called in The Prevention of Literature, an article, the dangerous proposition that intellectual honesty is a form of antisocial selfishness. The most dangerous implication of the proposition is that although most people readily agree to short-term tactical lying in time of war, if the war, or war preparation, becomes permanent, as it does in 1984, that's interesting considering what's happening here, perpetual war for perpetual peace, then the short-term becomes the long-term, lying becomes the norm. And one cannot, even by an act of will, confine it just to military matters. Lying becomes a habit in all areas of life, especially in a totalitarian state, in which control of the past by deception is deemed essential to protecting the myth of infallibility. In such a state, lying would still continue if concentration camps and secret police forces had ceased to be necessary, because history is seen as something to be created rather than learned. And man, isn't that a paragraph and a half, huh? Just as lying is not confined to anyone's sphere of activity, neither is the dominance of bureaucracy over the individual writer confined to merely instructing him or her on official political pronouncements. The state interference with the artist spreads beyond official duties more than it does in the case of a bureaucrat, because to lie about facts inevitably leads one into lying about feelings, which is the working domain more of the artist than of the bureaucrat. In any event, the integrity of the world, the would-be artist comes under heavy attack in the Ministry of Truth in 1984, which is not only concerned with altering the past, but primarily with keeping the population placid by giving easy access to simple-minded entertainment, including films, plays, novels, and poems written in a nondescript style. For example, the novels designed for proletarian consumption have only half a dozen plots and are swapped about by the rewrite squad. This is both the logical extension of the increasing centralization of the press, which Orwell noted in his essay, Boys' Weeklies, and the result of sophisticated technology, as predicted in The Road to Wigan Pier. In The Prevention of Literature, he describes how, quote, Disney films, for instance, are produced by what is essentially a factory process, the work being done partly mechanically and partly by teams of artists who have to subordinate their individual style, end of quote. The danger of all this is that in its further erosion of individual integrity, the weight of orthodox opinion gains and the sense of objective truth is diminished. Even if prose is composed in solitude, beyond a production line and out of the range of telescreens, in parentheses, as Orwell argues all serious prose has to be, end of parentheses, the heretical ideas it may contain are unlikely to spread because of the lack of non-official distribution channels and the punishment that would certainly follow underground distribution. The fate of the prose writer in a totalitarian society is crucial because it focuses attention on what Orwell saw as an unsolved dilemma, namely that while society can hardly be run in the sole interest of artists, who may not be as necessary to society as coal miners and milk carriers, without artists, civilizations perish. This dilemma was not solved by the state employing the writer, for, as we have seen, this was ruinous in forcing the artist inevitably to toe the official line. Further, to the suggestion that writers could write what they wanted in their spare time, Orwell, doubtless drawing on his own experience at the BBC, correctly countered that writing lies about something that doesn't matter to you is as physically tiring as writing about something that matters a great deal. In most cases, such efforts saps one's energy for almost any spare time writing. And this reminds me of something that Keith Jennison said to me back in 78. And he said, if you're going to do any serious writing and you want to make a living at it, whatever you do for subsistence, in the meantime, should not be writing. Save your best for yourself. Go handle luggage at the Greyhound bus depot. Do something that doesn't tax your mind, that it can be left with its full creativity for your art. This left Orwell, for all his socialist vision, with the belief that despite its grave faults, capitalism, particularly laissez-faire capitalism, at least afforded writers and artists in general an escape. By offering your wares to the free market, you could at least avoid the demeaning flatteries of patronization, on the one hand, and having to toe the official line, on the other. The implications are as clear for the citizen as for the artist. Socialism might bring collectivism, even equality, but there is a constant danger that government and technology, through the centralization that, ironically, is required to enforce that equality, may deny the freedom of the individual. The danger is especially acute for the writer, because, quote, literature as we know it is an individual thing, demanding mental honesty and a minimum of censorship, end of quote. Because he believed that, quote, this is even truer of prose than of verse, end of quote, or Orwell regarded, we pick up the quote again, the atmosphere of orthodoxy as being completely ruinous to the novel, the most anarchical of all forms of literature. And that's anarchical of all forms of literature. Too many syllables, too little time. In 1944, Orwell was still confident that a people, in this case the English, could centralize their economy without destroying freedom in doing so. In 1984, he is obviously in grave doubt. In his treatment of language control, however, a curious thing happens. Although prose has fallen victim to Big Brother's deadly censorship in the superstate, verse of unknown authorship is permitted. This does not mean that verse is not carefully watched. For example, Ampleforth, one of Smith's co-workers, is jailed for allowing the word God to remain in a poem. But it does mean that verse is relatively tolerated. Why? Well, says Orwell, even in a society where liberty and individuality had been extinguished, there would still be need for patriotic songs and heroic ballads celebrating victories. This toleration of verse extends particularly to the proles in 1984, because the inner party considers them stupid and therefore harmless, revealing what might prove to be a grave miscalculation on the part of the totalitarian administration. We are told that the party, by means of a versificator, manufactures apparently meaningless rhymes set to music and hate songs to make the proles' lot more acceptable. What the party does not take into account, however, is the possibility of improvisation. The fact, as Orwell notes in The Prevention of Literature, that when many primitive people compose verse communally, someone begins to improvise. Somebody else chips in with a line or a rhyme, the first singer breaks down, and so the process continues until there exists a whole song or ballad which had no identifiable author. Such undeniable authorship would make it impossible to arrest those guilty of heresy against the regime's orthodoxy and might encourage others to join in. The originally meaningless verse could thus quickly become as potentially subversive as mime theater, which, in saying nothing, can say anything. This possibility grows in proportion to the bureaucratic tendency, especially among those who are unable to grasp the subtlety of the poetic nuance and are too embarrassed to admit it, to look for form rather than content as a guide to what is permissible. It is the known form that gives comfort to Dorothy in The Clergyman's Daughter, by providing her with the familiarity of a traditional hymn. Just so, it affords ease of mind to a bureaucrat who is anxious to do everything by the book, like a border guard who looks more for the correct size and shape of a passport rather than for what is in it. Continuity of form is vitally important to the inner party, for whether it be a question of hate rhyme or a newspeak sentence, the continuity of form allows the party, and to a lesser extent Whitehall in Burmese days, to present new policy in familiar doctrinal dress, as in the case of the enemy subtly changing from Eurasia to East Asia. In this way, the party can make new policies appear not to contradict supposedly infallible party precepts. This explains why, when real change comes in totalitarian societies, it is so often signaled by a change in the form of a message rather than by the message itself. This is bred a brand of scholarship in the West that, under the name of Kremlinology, that would be like Kremlinology, right? Kremlin, attempts, along with other techniques, to detect real change in the Soviet Union by concentrating upon minute change in form. And we'll hold it right there. That would be part 4 of The Road to Orwell, and we'll pick it up in chapter 10 of Orwell, The Road to Airstrip 1 by Ian Slater, and that'll be in part 5.
Please fasten your seatbelts.